This episode of New Politics was released on the 15th of October, 2022, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, the calls for an inquiry into media diversity are getting louder and louder. Is the Labor government breaking promises, or is it just business as usual? And the return of the Ruby Princess. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
No, I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription. But whether it's a subscription or if you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au, and all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. There have been calls for a parliamentary inquiry into media diversity in Australia and generally the behaviour of the mainstream media, and these calls have been made for about 20 years or so. The independent member for Goldstein, Zoe Daniel, and she used to work as a journalist before entering Parliament, so she should know quite a lot about this. She currently has a motion in Parliament, and that was introduced in early September, with secondary debates in the final week of the last parliamentary session about whether an inquiry should be held or not. Australia does have one of the most concentrated media landscapes in the world. It's dominated by two companies, and that's News Limited and Nine Media. There's also issues with the Australian Press Council, and that's funded by the mainstream media, and that's the place where you go to lodge a complaint about the media, and it's pretty much close to useless. And generally, the mainstream media in Australia tends to be supportive of conservative political interests, and if you're not of a conservative persuasion, well, that's not very good news. David, we'd highly recommend an inquiry into the media in Australia, and you'd expect that this is something that a Labor government would be supportive of, considering that they're usually on the end of most of the attacks from the media, whether they're in government or opposition. So what are they waiting for?
It is difficult because it's all perceived power, particularly in the media. Newspaper sales are dropping. Far less people read newspapers today than they did in 1996. And in 1996, less people were reading newspapers than they were in 1946. So we're watching the long, slow, protracted death of print media as a viable business. Of course, a lot of that goes online. But people aren't buying mastheads. They see a link, they click on it, and they read it. Maybe. The power that a company like Nine Media gets is a very perceived power. It's all about the headline. It's all about managing perceptions in that first 2 seconds. Bang. Prime Minister blunders. Turns out he tripped up the stairs after a long day of meetings and missed the stairs. Not really a blunder, but people see that and start to associate the Prime Minister with blundering. Foreign Minister in gaffe. Turns out it wasn't a gaffe. Turns out that wrong advice was given about who the foreign minister was meeting. And it can go the other way too for their favourites. I remember Australia Needs Tony. Turns out Australia Needs Tony like a hole in the head. But the whole way that they shape the personalities. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison was the Prime Minister, but it's Albanese to try and undermine that authority that you might get as a holder of the office of Prime Minister. So this is why the media keep in, and politicians who are surrounded by media, and for the last, since really the Lyons government in the 30s, part of their job has been managing the media to present themselves in the best way possible and to minimize damage. Now that's okay, that's fair enough. You're accountable to the public. You're not expected to just disappear and do your job. You have to be seen to be doing your job, and you have to defend decisions and all. And that's all very well and good. But I don't think psychologically our political system has moved on from a very influential media, and television too. Broadcast television is a very, very big part of it. Now, why Labor doesn't, and this goes back to my point, why Labor really takes its time One, if it does, there will be a media howling of, look at these people trying to stop good, honest Aussie businesses. Murdoch's American, Channel 10 is owned by CBS. But okay, let's give them that for the moment. It's trying to stop good Aussie businesses doing their job and holding them to account. But if Labor announce that, they go into trouble. What Labor has to start to realise, and I think the Teals realised this, and Kevin Rudd seemed to realise it, and I think Anthony Albanese also realised it, that you don't need the mainstream media on your side. Now, Kevin Rudd had the mainstream media on his side for a bit, then they turned on him very viciously. Anthony Albanese was elected without really the support of the mainstream media till the last couple of days when it was clear that the Liberal Party were pretty much in an unwinnable position. I think the realisation is coming through. Whether this realisation will then lead to an inquiry or even reforms to media ownership laws, myself, when it comes to that, I think no one should own more than 10% of any media in the country, with the possible exception of the ABC being the national broadcaster.
And Australia might be a country with a free and easy approach to life, but it might surprise many people that it actually has a very poor press freedom record. According to Reporters Without Borders, in the 2022 Index of Press Freedom, and that's where it combines all of this data relating to media concentration, media rules, defamation, arrests and detention of journalists, Australia is actually ranked number 39 out of 180 countries, and it's dropped from number 12 in 2002, that's 20 years ago, and that number has dropped dramatically over the past 2 or 3 years. And it's mainly the Scandinavian countries that do have a high ranking. New Zealand is at number 11. Australia is slightly above the United States, which is ranked at number 42. But the big issue for Australia is the concentration of media ownership. And media ownership rules have changed over the years, most notably when the Hawke government amended the rules, which allowed media ownership of 75% in print media or electronic media, but not both. And that was in 1986. And many people have suggested that the current media concentration issues that we've got today, that's when it all started. The Turnbull government also scrapped the 2 in 3 markets rule in 2017. And I think Malcolm Turnbull was hoping that this would help his government survive, but it didn't. And then there's the media bargaining code, and that's a slightly different issue, but that's also helped to shore up media concentration as well. And here we are with the most concentrated media markets in the world. So I've gone through some of that history there. So governments have brought this on. So I think it's up to governments to undo this mess as well.
It's going to take courage, something that governments don't like. That wonderful quote from Yes Minister where Jim Hacker suggests something and the advisor says, oh, that's very courageous, and Jim backs down from it. But it's not really, because the media, not only is it getting less readers, it's not getting the range of readers. There was a time where the whole political spectrum would read the Sydney Morning Herald, the Herald Sun in Melbourne. Most of the political spectrum would read the Courier Mail. Now it's a lot less, more towards people who agree with the general philosophy of the paper. And as that relatively far right wing cohort is diminishing in influence and in popularity, the papers, and they're trying, admittedly, they're trying, but it's not working. They're trying to get back to where everybody's reading the paper. Same with the news. Everybody would watch Channel 9 or Channel 10 or Channel 7 news. Now, much less. Independent media is getting bigger, or what I'd call semi-independent media, like Crikey, for example, the Monthly and the Saturday Paper and things like that, who have a lot of funding behind them and are funded by some of the bigger media players in the country. And that's not to disparage either publication. They're both pretty good at what they do. The Guardian, a multinational business, posits itself as that when it's not really, but it has a very committed readership.
And I guess there have been those viewer changes as well, or listener changes, or readership changes as well. There's been social changes and technological changes, but some of those legislative issues that I referred to before, that was brought in to make the media markets more sustainable and prop up the industry in a time of technological change. But that's partially some of the reasoning, but these changes were mainly done to get government support from the media, and supporting Kerry Packer at the time and Rupert Murdoch as well. And if you've got people like that on your side, well, it makes governing a whole lot easier. And sure, governments can come in and support failing industries if they've got issues within that sector. And this is what they did several years ago to prop up regional newspapers, only for News Corporation to buy them up and then close them down. But the mainstream media is also chasing the money. That's what they've always done, and this is what you'd expect them to do. But with the diminishing audience that you referred to before, which is generally more conservative and older, they're producing content that fits those audiences and increasingly producing content and editorial which seems to be more in line with their advertisers as well. And as far as I can tell, we've got this terrible nexus of a downward spiral. It's between conservative political parties through to conservative advertisers and through to conservative audiences, and then the feedback loop continues. And I realise that the mainstream media doesn't have the clout that it used to have, but this spiral and the players who are part of this downward spiral, I don't think that's a sign of a healthy democracy.
No, not at all. You need a lot of voices. You need right-wing voices, you need left-wing voices, you need centrist voices. You don't want the type of balance the ABC tries to bring in from time to time, where we will have climate scientists and then a climate denier.
Well, that's all very entertaining, but it doesn't actually add to public debate at all.
Exactly. To watch Malcolm Roberts get slapped around by Brian Cox might be entertaining for a bit, but after a while you're thinking, well, what have we learned from this? Not very much. And it's wasted Brian Cox's time and probably wasted Malcolm Roberts' time. I noticed that one of the papers put in an article by a executive from oil and gas saying how a windfall tax would be very bad because there's already a lot of levies and that oil and gas are already paying their way. And some people were saying, well, this is just stupid. But to be fair, even though the argument was unsustainable and it was a poorly written article, I didn't mind the fact that the paper put that in. They didn't have someone from Greenpeace or the Department of the Environment or a environmentally sustainable company come in and say, this is why we need a super profits on these big companies, or even another economist. But having that argument out there, even if it's showing how wrongheaded and poor it is, wasn't bad, but it wasn't balanced as such.
Well, I guess the question has to be, well, what should the Labor government do now? And we can see that they've been very mindful of reactions to the Stage 3 tax cuts, and that's been a carefully managed process where they seem to be giving the impression that they will be repealed and then close down the debate by saying that they won't be repealed. And governments do need to do their media management effectively, and many people have been saying, well, come on, Labor, you're now in the government, do something about media diversity. And doesn't really matter what you do. The media, especially News Corporation, well, that's going to frame Labor in a negative light. So do something now that's in the public interest. And a lot of this is easier said than done. The former political advisor to Tony Blair in the UK, Alastair Campbell, he said that News Corporation is like a wild dog in the corner of the room and you just have to keep feeding it to keep it quiet. And he's also had a few astute things to say about political journalism, and here's a snippet of what he said at the Leveson Media Inquiry in 2011.
I quote there one of Rupert Murdoch's Australian executives who once said to me that British journalism is the best in the world and the worst in the world, and it's sometimes in the same edition. But I think it is important to remember that some of British journalism is the best in the world. I watched your evidence, the evidence in the inquiry yesterday, and I think you saw some very different aspects of British journalism, which included the best and the worst. But the best, I would defend, and I do defend, a free press. My argument that runs through this document that I've given to you is that the freedom of the press that is being defended most loudly by those who are describe anybody who dares criticise them as an attack upon the freedom of the press, that actually that has become a press that is barely worth defending. What I think we should defend is a genuinely free press. And at the moment, I think we have a press that has just become, frankly, putrid in many of its elements. And let me emphasise, not all journalists and not all titles. And the terrible thing that has happened since I was at the point at which the culture was changing, without a doubt. But what's happened is a very, very small number of people have actually completely changed the newspaper industry, so that, frankly, they've now besmirched the name of virtually every journalist in the country.
The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, he did say that complaining about the media is like complaining about the umpire in a football game. But if you don't do something about it, you're going to keep getting all of these decisions going against you. And David, I haven't played football for a long, long time, but sure, I know that you don't complain about the umpire during a game because that's not going to make any difference. But you lodge your complaints to the association. You register your concerns and make sure that the umpire plays fair and plays by the rules. So Albanese is actually in that position of now being the player, the umpire, and the association. So this is the time that you make changes, when you've got the power to do so. And things are not just going to change by themselves. And I know it's not as easy as saying, well, bring on a Royal Commission into the media diversity right now, because as you mentioned before, David, the right-wing media will attack it endlessly. And in politics, you want to avoid the problems before they do arise. But you can't just avoid every problem because you'll never get anything done.
Exactly. It is challenging. You don't want to be seen to be media in other countries where it's completely controlled by the government, not the parliament or not the Commonwealth, but the government. And you don't want the perception to get around that you're writing the headlines and making them say what they are. But rules can be changed. Any rule that does fall within the public interest, I think, is defensible and should be looked at. Truth in journalism laws, which, interestingly enough, are in place in New Zealand, are in place in Canada, and their right-wing parties are much less extreme and much smarter and more savvy and hence even more electable than their counterparts in Britain, Australia and America, where these things don't exist. There's been a bit more radical talk in Canada recently from some of their leaders, but it's not where the whole party has been hijacked by the far right. And you get people like the columnists who can say all types of outrageous things and not be held to account. Now, to be fair, Andrew Bolt went down under Section 18C, which then the press and the government at the time did their very best to repeal, so that he wouldn't be seen as a racist by the courts. And I note that his racism has only toned down a little bit.
Well, that complaint against Andrew Bolt at the time, that was actually commenced through a complaint lodged with the Australian Press Council. And the Australian Greens have lodged a complaint to the Australian Press Council at the moment about how Lydia Thorpe's response to The Voice to Parliament was reported, where the Australian newspaper strongly suggested that she was going to campaign against The Voice to Parliament. Now, Senator Thorpe, she has been critical of The Voice to Parliament, but she never actually said that she would campaign against it. So that was totally wrong, but I'd be surprised if she does get a favourable response from the Press Council. Former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, he also had that petition to Parliament, which gathered over 500,000 signatures, and that was for an inquiry into media ownership and media behaviour in Australia. So there is public support for this, and it's an issue that's not going to go away, but it seems like there isn't public support for this from the government, and I think that's what the problem is. And you referred to this before, David, that some people have been suggesting that the Labor Party won government this year, despite all the garbage that was thrown at them by the media, including the ABC. And it looks like the Andrews government in Victoria is going to be re-elected in November, despite all the daily bile that is thrown at them by the Herald Sun and Sky News. So maybe it's just not so relevant anymore. And again, independent media, you referred to this before, David, independent media is becoming larger, but it's only 10% of the newspaper market. News Corporation is 64% and Nine Media is 26%. So that's 90% of print media is owned by two corporations. And in electronic media and the internet, independent media does have a much larger share. So we can see that the mainstream media is becoming less influential, but I guess it gets down to the heart of what a democratic system is. And as time goes on, it seems that legacy media is going to become the representative of conservative interests, while a growing independent media is going to become more representative of non-conservative interests. And I think people will just direct themselves to those areas which reflect their political interests.
Some years ago, I used to read Quadrant regularly because it had some very good articles. I didn't agree with anywhere near all the articles. It had great literature. But probably around the time of the Rudd government, it changed direction. And Keith Windschuttle took over as editor and it became a lot less accepting of other ideas. It became a lot less interesting to read because it was just the same hectoring points made over and over and over and over again. Now, it was always a right bias. It was always a conservative bias. And that's fine. But it was the one thing any journal or any magazine or any newspaper should not be is boring. And as we become more and more partisan in our approach, things get more and more boring. People avoid each other. When they argue, they don't argue over substance, they argue over petty things. And of course, this is where the media owners like it because it means that they don't actually have to pay their journalists to do any work. You can just bring in more opinion people. You don't have to do anything expensive like investigative journalism. You don't have to do any policy analysis. You don't have to look at anything. I know Julie Bishop was in the paper the other day doing a fashion spread. That's fine. She can wear what she wants and I'm not going to judge her. And I'm not even really going to judge that part of the paper for putting it in. But it was the most significant political thing in the paper of that day. And I suspect it's because Labor's doing a fairly decent job and it's too hard to find the stuff that they can be criticized on. So that the papers are using distraction to keep the, I was going to say has-beens, but I'll call them once-words, in the paper, which of course, for people who aren't quite engaged, keeps that side of politics in the forefront. But of course, the people who aren't quite engaged aren't that interested, so I doubt they're winning them over anyway, if they're reading that far into the paper.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Amazon Music, Spotify, YouTube and SoundCloud, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can also support New Politics through Patreon.
It started out when I was cleaning dishes and the phone rang in the hall. I was drawn to it against my wishes, ugly memories of the wall. I didn't count on mass destruction. When I saw you, it was the way I made you feel. I hadn't seen such mass destruction till I saw you. It was the way I made you feel.
Politicians make a lot of promises, but it's the broken promises that everyone tends to remember. Back in 1996, the former Prime Minister John Howard, he introduced the idea of core and non-core promises into the political vernacular, and that was after he broke some key election promises after finding out that he couldn't keep them, and the media at the time seemed to accept this idea. The former Prime Minister Tony Abbott said this on the day before the 2013 federal election.
I trust everyone actually listened to what Joe Hockey has said last week and again this week. No cuts to education, no cuts to health, no change to pensions, no change to the GST, and no cuts to the ABC or SBS.
But then went on to cut funding to education, cut funding to health, and cut funding to the ABC and SBS. So that's a very clear breach of a promise and public trust. But the point is that making the promise didn't stop Tony Abbott from making all of those cutbacks anyway. There's been a lot of focus on stage three tax cuts and broken promises, and the media has made it very clear to the public that this will be a big, big breach of public trust if Labor does repeal the tax cuts, while at the same time it seems to be pushing them to break this promise as well. But there are other areas where the Labor government is pushing the boundaries of what was promised or what they discussed in the last federal election campaign. There are a few issues of broken trust up for debate. Labor promised to deliver an anti-corruption commission with teeth, but now there's a few sticking points about transparency and public hearings. Labor also took the previous coalition government to task about the secrecy of the National Cabinet. While they didn't actually promise to release National Cabinet documents, they've closed down debate about making these documents public. And they've also removed COVID isolation requirements without releasing the medical evidence from the chief health officer to support this decision. And that's one area that they also criticised the previous coalition government on. And it seems that they're now doing exactly the same. All political leaders and all governments are going to be caught out on these issues. So why do they keep making promises that they can't keep and sometimes keep the promises that they should be getting rid of, such as the Stage 3 tax cuts?
Again, it goes back to media manipulation. Someone at some point, I think, has got to stand up and say, we're not playing to the media anymore. We're doing the job. We will tell the media what we're doing because that is right and good and all the things that it should be. The public do need to know what's going on with their money. But Labor being concerned about not breaking a promise that I think can be fairly reasonably argued was not theirs to make nor break, I think says a lot. Now, again, it has been pointed out that it's 2 years before these come into effect and there's two budgets before then. They might be just looking at the results and thinking closer to the election might be a time to say, yeah, we're going to drop these in our next budget before the election because they are wrong and unjust and shouldn't have been brought in. And we've been doing all this other stuff, the referendum and reforms to the public service and all the other stuff they've been doing. And it's now time to finally put this to bed and vote for us. And that's a perfectly valid thing for any politician to do. Might not be the best way of doing it from our perspective, but from a more general public perspective and maximising the votes, that might be the best way of going about it.
Oh, well, we're actually sick of all this debate about the tax cuts,
yeah.
But we're only commenting on this because that's what the media seems to be focused upon as well, and they're pretty much obsessed about it. But we can see what the media is actually trying to do here. They've already lined up to let everyone know that repealing the tax cuts will be a major breach of public trust, and they're making it seem like Labor has already broken a promise on this. And then on the other hand, they're actually egging on Labor to repeal the tax cuts, suggesting that it's economically irresponsible to proceed. And sometimes you just cannot win with the media, but politicians are paid the big bucks to deal with these sort of difficult decisions. And of course, it would be better if politicians kept to whatever they promised, but that's just not how politics tends to work. Circumstances change, events change, and the things that you promised at the time might have seemed like a pretty good idea. But then when you get into government, you realise that it's actually quite a stupid idea. And that's why politicians try to keep their messaging ambiguous and hope that no one will pick up on the details. But the other factor is that few people in the electorate actually expect politicians to keep their promises. So when it does happen, it's not such a surprise. But they will remember the bigger promises that are broken. And I guess that's one reason why the media keeps pushing this tax cuts issue. They just want as many people as possible to remember this issue over the next couple of years.
Was it Michael Sukkar who tried to say Penny Wong's gone off on another foreign jaunt, which as foreign minister she'd be expected to do, and it was to the South Pacific, I think, where Australia has lost a lot of influence under the Liberal government, and it's all high-powered meetings. Of course, being foreign minister, the diary is publicly accessible for the most part, and it's all high-powered meetings and diplomatic events to try and get Australia back to where it should be in this area of the world, to try and work with other interested powers like China so that everybody's a bit happy, to try and work with the governments of the places she's going to ensure them that Australia's interest is to support them, something that would never occur to any of the Liberal backbench, it seems. So again, the hope was, I'd note that no media picked it up, interestingly, there to be praised, because it was a ridiculous idea to suggest that one of the hardest working foreign ministers that we've ever had and one of the most productive foreign ministers we've ever had 4 months into it was not doing a job is demonstrably wrong. She's off on another jaunt, sucking taxpayer money, particularly after the last 9 years, was rather rich.
Oh, well, Labor did promise that they were going to resolve the issues in, or the diplomatic issues in the Pacific Islands, so they haven't broken any promises there. But a few weeks ago on New Politics, we discussed the repeal of the LAW law tax cuts back in 1994, and that did cost Labor quite a lot of political capital, and they just couldn't close the debate down at that time. And there was a lot of hysteria about the carbon tax being introduced in 2011, even though it wasn't a tax at all, and that cost Labor dearly in the 2013 election. In politics, broken promises can be overlooked if politicians never revisit them, if they deflect and then they change the conversation to something else. And John Howard was the master of this technique after he was stymied on core and non-core promises in 1996. And aside from introducing the GST in 1999, he was never clear on a promise again. He always muddied the water. He always obfuscated. It was ambiguous. And even with the work choices legislation in 2005, he publicly hid what the legislation was meant to be all about and just kept on emphasising the supposed positives from that legislation. Tony Abbott, similar sort of issue. He never talked about those cutbacks to the ABC, SBS, Medicare and education ever again. It didn't make too much of a difference for him. He was booted out by his own party after 2 years as Prime Minister. But at least it was one issue he didn't need to get himself tangled up in. And we can see how the media treats Labor differently, of course, and that's not anything new. It's always been the case in Australian politics, but it is up to political parties to manage the cards that they're dealt with, and it does depend on what the issue is as well.
My own probably anarchic and ultimately wrong approach would be to ignore them altogether, just send them press releases and have press conferences, but not engage with trying to manage, just do the job. But we have a generation of politicians who aren't ready to do that yet, as I sort of alluded to earlier. It goes back that we need serious media reform in the country. And hopefully in the near future, the federal government, with the support of the independents, and I suspect given what some of the independents went through, at least some of them would be very open to reforming the media, not to do anything but make it a fairer playing ground for everybody.
And I think there has been this feeling within centre and centre-left politics that although there was a belief that Labor was inadequate on the key issues of climate change, not having high enough targets, support for coal industries and their support for those tax cuts for higher income earners, I think there was a perception that it was best to get rid of the coalition government and then if Labor won the election, which is what they actually did, then start putting pressure on the Labor government to get them to change their policies or change their approach on certain things. And I guess we're at that point where we do have to look at the behaviour of the Labor government now that they're in office. And National Cabinet removed the COVID isolation rules and there was little explanation for this. It was just announced and they didn't release any medical advice about this. And this was one area Albanese criticised the coalition government on, hastily made decisions without releasing the medical advice and National Cabinet acting in secrecy. And now that he's in government, Albanese seems to be doing the same. Now, he didn't actually make a promise on this that he'd release all National Cabinet documents and reveal all the medical advice to support whatever decisions they made, but it's a double standard. And this is the sort of behaviour that we used to get from Scott Morrison. It was a fine line between his actions and what he actually said. He always seemed to have an escape clause somewhere in his words. And just looking at the COVID situation across Australia, now the daily COVID numbers have come down dramatically. In New South Wales at the beginning of August, the 7-day average was 16,000 cases per day. 2 months later, it's down to a 7-day average of 1,300 cases per day. That's around 7 or 8% of what it was just 2 months ago. And there's been similar drops across all of the country. But I think it just does get down to the courage of your convictions. And I know that politicians want to avoid the problems before they arise, as I mentioned before. But if Albanese and the National Cabinet was so convinced in their decision to remove COVID isolation rules, well, they should just come out and give all their reasons for doing so. That's how you bring the electorate in with your confidence. It gives them clear reasons for your actions. And I think the Labor government missed an opportunity to do this.
I said, I think last week, a little bit more courage or a little bit more conviction or a bit more demonstrated conviction, I think would do us all a bit of good. And you can ignore the mainstream media. they're not going to like it anyway unless you do. And even if you do exactly what they want, they're still going to complain, saying, well, that's typical Labor going against their principles. Next election, anything could happen. I don't think the Liberal Party will be returned, but we could have a fairly severe minority government. We could have a slight minority government. I would behave as if there would be an election being called next week and you had to get everything done as soon as possible.
And the art of politics and most government management, that's all based around smoke and mirrors and trying out different effects. And it is that process of trying to achieve the agenda that you're interested in, and that might be deemed to be difficult, but giving the semblance of normality and making it seem like business as usual. But this was a problem for the previous coalition government. They were just trying to make it look like they were a very, very busy government without actually doing very much. But this process always ends up being found out by the public, as the coalition found out with their election loss this year. But to me, it seems that Labor is trying to do the opposite. It's trying to implement its agenda without publicly saying too much about it. We don't get the big announcements that we used to get when Scott Morrison was Prime Minister. So I guess Labor has now got a different problem to the coalition. But there is an expectation that new governments act quickly once they get into office. The coalition started announcing cutbacks almost immediately after they won the election in 2013 and continued their cutbacks in the 2014 budget. Labor will have its first budget announcement coming up on October the 26th, so it's just a couple of weeks away. And this will be the first major indication of what the Labor government will be like. And we've had a few brushstrokes here and there, but everything before this has been window dressing, clearing the throats and warming up the seats. And I think the budget announcement in October, I think this is when all the action will commence.
The budget will be very interesting. It may be one of those budgets that fundamentally change Australia, hopefully for the better. I'm not sure we could get much worse, to be fair, but hopefully put us back onto the inclusive, active, big picture, imaginative, creative country that we've had flashes of over the last 40 years, but never quite got there. But hopefully the budget will start us on that, even if it's going to take a couple of budget cycles to get there.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Amazon Music, Spotify, YouTube and SoundCloud, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can also support New Politics through Patreon.
The Ruby Princess is back in the news. The class action trial against Carnival PLC has commenced in Sydney, and that's over the Ruby Princess incident in March 2020 at the beginning of the pandemic, and that's where 663 Australians were infected with COVID and 28 of those passengers died. And the arguments for the plaintiff are that the entire incident wasn't an accident and the ship should have never sailed at all. There was a special commission of inquiry into the Ruby Princess, and that report was completed in August 2020, but it was a whitewash of a report and couldn't hold anyone responsible for the incident. But hopefully this class action trial will shine some more light on these events.
We're still not quite sure who made the final decision to let everybody off the boat. The latest piece of evidence suggested that Scott Morrison, as dual health minister without anybody knowing, may have done it. I'm not suggesting that that's 100%, but certainly another figure was thrown into the mix with those revelations. That you had New South Wales Health blaming Customs, you had New South Wales Health blaming Border Force, you had Border Force blaming Federal Health, you had Federal Health blaming New South Wales Health. As far as I see it, and I'm more than happy to be corrected as always, New South Wales Health have no control over international borders. They have control over state borders, but the Ruby Princess was from essentially overseas. So as far as I can tell, it's a federal issue. We may see certain former ex-prime ministers being called in to try and explain untenable positions. And given that he's not great in defending himself, this could be a very interesting inquiry if it gets to that.
Oh, well, also a parliamentary inquiry that can't find who was responsible for any of the decisions that were made during the Ruby Princess incident. Well, that's not really much of an inquiry. And I think that report by Brett Walker was compromised. It seemed to be manipulated, so it would look for information in all the wrong places. But a court case is a completely different process to a government inquiry. Carnival PLC, that's a corporation that wants to defend itself and its reputation, and there's large sums of money involved here. So it's not going to be too concerned about calling out a few politicians or revealing more information than the New South Wales government would want to reveal. So this has got the potential to be quite damaging to the New South Wales government, and along with a few other issues that are running alongside it at the moment. The John Barilaro job to New York issue, that's a gift that keeps giving for the Labor Party. And the release for the New South Wales ICAC findings against former New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian. We've been waiting for about 8 months for these, so there could be quite a few fireworks in the lead up to the New South Wales election in March 2023.
We could see a total clean out of senior New South Wales figures. It's hard to know what we'll see till the inquiry is happening, but just looking at it strategically, I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I don't think this can be put on the shoulders of one person, even if the final decision on the night was from one person. I think there was a whole range of systemic failures. I think there was a whole range of personal failures. The rumours circulated for weeks, and I believe them to be wrong, that certain senior federal ministers had family on board the ship. I don't believe that that's the case, but it'd be interesting to see why the final decisions were made. And sometimes these inquiries, and if they're done in the way that very forensic way that we saw with the Gladys Berejiklian inquiry in New South Wales, where every single piece of evidence was picked up and made to be explained, it will be interesting to see what happened and who was responsible. And I think we're going to see names that we haven't seen before, and I think we're going to see a long line of the usual suspects.
Just getting back to federal politics to finish up on, there was a Resolve poll that came out during the week, and again, not much difference in the polling from the previous month. Labor has 58% in two-party preferred voting, which means that the coalition is polling at 42%. Albanese is still preferred Prime Minister by 53% to Peter Dutton's 18%, and the net approval rating is 36 points for Albanese, and Dutton's is minus 10 points at the moment. And we also have to remember that Albanese had similar figures to Dutton's at the same point in his leadership against Scott Morrison. And today, Albanese is Prime Minister and Scott Morrison isn't. So there is a little ray of hope for Peter Dutton. But the interesting issue about this poll is that all the key indicators, and that's economic management, healthcare, aged care and education, Labor is way ahead of the coalition, and it's even on national security and defence. And economic management and national security and defence are seen more as the issues that are owned by Conservative parties. So even though there are issues for the Labor Party, which seem to be manageable at the moment, and with a lot of pressure being piled up on the media and the opposition, there is a perception in the electorate that they're actually doing very well. And that, of course, can change very quickly, and that might change very quickly after the October budget is released. But these polls are good for Anthony Albanese at the moment and not so good for Peter Dutton. And they've been like this ever since he became the leader of the opposition.
The difference is that, and here come the "you guys hate the coalition and are totally biased to Labor," Anthony Albanese is fundamentally a likable person. Even if you don't agree with him, he comes across as a decent, good person who you might, if you were stuck on a plane next to him, you wouldn't be too bothered. Peter Dutton doesn't. But again, it is public perception more so than private experience that counts. being a politician isn't being the nicest person in the room often. Sometimes you have to make very hard decisions. Sometimes you've got to be tough. Sometimes you've got to get into political stoushes. Sometimes your behavior isn't really becoming. But if it gets what's best for the country, then people accept that. But Dutton has never seemed to work in the interests of the country either. And again, it may be just the way he presents what he's doing, but we look at this very closely and we've never seen it. And that's the difference. And that's how you come back from a low approval rating. John Howard, the very famous bulletin front cover, why does he even bother? Because his ratings were so low. 8 or 9 years later, he was prime minister and becomes Australia's second longest prime minister. But again, John Howard spent a lot of time meeting everyday people, talking with everyday people. And I don't mean having deep conversations about what their issues were, but just asking how they were. A very personable person. I have met John Howard, and he's a very personable person. Hello, John, if you're listening.
Well, hello, Peter, if you're listening too.
This is advice, Peter, not criticism. One of the things with politics is that 90% of it is if you're presenting an authentic view of yourself, that will help. And I think the softening down of Peter Dutton hasn't worked because he's not a soft character. Anthony Albanese has that softness and personability about him. There'll be some of our listeners who say, I think Anthony Albanese is a phony and a fake. And that's fine. Charisma can be lost on everyone. I've mentioned before Boris Johnson's charisma, that on his supporters is absolutely part of his appeal. His lack of supporters, his non-supporters, I'm sorry, don't get it and don't understand it. Same with John Howard. Same with Paul Keating. Same with Kevin Rudd. Same with Julia Gillard. You either get it or you don't. And I think Peter Dutton, in trying to please everybody, is pleasing nobody. And I don't know that he'll be able to get back from this. But again, stranger things, things that are almost as strange have happened. And this could be a new boundary for what constitutes strange in Australia.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.